to come and talk about chronic relapses for around 30 minutes. So, Cameron, would you like to take the floor?
Thanks, Kylie. Appreciate that. And welcome, everybody. It's great to be here. My name's Cameron. I'm a member of Cocaine Anonymous. And I hope you can understand my accent. I hear it's pretty thick. Whenever I speak with people in Glasgow, I think, I know it's English, but I can't understand a damn word they're saying. You know, anyhow. I love the accents. I love, you know, the UK Fellowship has been very kind to me over the last year. I don't know what's going on in the UK, but you guys are all fired up about recovery. And, you know, I always thought there's only one thing more contagious than enthusiasm, and that's a lack of it. And I find very little lack of enthusiasm in the UK. You guys are great. So, you know, our story is supposed to disclose in a general way what we're like, what happened, what we're like today. I'm going to briefly qualify so you don't think I just wandered in from some donut shop here in Toronto, Ontario, because I'm lonely and needed to chat with some people. What was I like as an untreated addict? You know, first and foremost, more than anything else on this planet, I truly love drinking and using alcohol, drugs, and I consider alcohol just another drug. I love the effect I get when I do that stuff. I love it more than every job I've been fired from. I was a needle user. I was irresponsible. I'd leave my dirty needles laying around the house. I remember awful days where I'd wake up, my son, who was 4 years old at the time, is playing squirt guns with a dirty needle. You know, I felt awful as a father, but it didn't have the power to sober me up. As much as I disliked that, I preferred drugs and alcohol a lot more. I was willing to risk my family, my marriage. My wife would beg, plead, offer those frothy emotional appeals, threatening me with divorce. But I loved the effect of alcohol more than my own marriage, drugs more than my own marriage. And then eventually, you know, things got so bad, I remember the doctor diagnosing me with liver disease because I was drinking a lot of bourbon in those days. I don't know what it is about bourbon. It brings out my inner asshole. And my doctor said, Cameron, you got liver disease. And if it continues, you're going to die from it. And the first thought that crossed my mind was, I need a drink right now. That was awful news. Now, I always call them the muggles. That's a Harry Potter term for non-wizard. The normies, the earth people, some people call the, you know, the regular folks. I call them muggles. They don't understand us. My wife's what I call a JDD woman. She says, just don't drink. Well, you know, that is the answer, but for some reason, I can't seem to implement that solution. And, you know, an analogy I love to use, one thing I love about CAs, you can be a little grittier, a little crasser. I try not to be vulgar. And when I speak in AA, you can't swear, you can't be vulgar. So I came up with an analogy to describe the untreated alcoholic addict, and that is, I'm like a dog that returns to its vomit. You ever seen a dog that makes itself foully sick and it throws it up and then it eats its own vomit only to throw it up again? That's what I'm like as an untreated addict. I'm like a dog that continually returns to my own vomit, getting sicker and sicker and sicker. And it's baffling. Now, in the beginning, you know, it seemed like the answer because untreated, I'm restless, I'm irritable, I'm discontented, I'm bored, I'm depressed, I'm anxious, and I don't like feeling that way. So I seek a solution, and my solution is to drink and use. That's my solution. It's not my problem. Running out is a problem, but my solution to what ails me is drinking and drugging. And in the beginning, it seemed like the answer. Remember that when we first started experimenting with drugs and alcohol and we got that effect and we went, yeah, this is what I've been looking for, right? And it seemed like the answer. But as the years rolled out, for me, it became more and more problematic. And it went from being that luxury where I could say, oh, wasn't that a great time at the pub last night, to something quite dark, ugly, and unimaginable. And it ended up where, you know, I'd like to tell you, I'm just going to go to the pub, have a pint, maybe a couple shots of bourbon and come home. But once I start, I can't really predict what it's going to look like. It might last the evening. It might last a day, a week, a month, a year. It could go on for years. I don't know. Once I start, I have no ability to control my consumption. And then eventually there's that moment where I come out of it and I go, oh my God, I got to stop. I can't go on like this. And I make a firm resolution not to do it again. And I know we've all done that coming off a run, right? How many times we've made that resolution, that solemn oath, that promise. Hell, I'd sign a contract with Satan himself if I thought it would sober me up. And it seems truthful. Like I'm convinced if lie detector tests were hooked up to any one of us, it would register as truthful. But what's the problem is I can't live with it anymore, but I don't know how to live without it. And so I enter into what I call sobriety. And I did this in the first 8 months of coming into the rooms. I went into the rooms. No one ever approached me with a solution. I just sat there in sobriety. And although I wasn't drinking and using, my mind got sicker and sicker and sicker. And I became more and more insane and irritable and restless. Now, for some, it's a very short-lived proposition. The liar comes out of remission. Because I got this liar that lives in my head and it loves the effect produced by alcohol and drugs and doesn't under any circumstance want to give it up. And it's built this research institute in my brain where it's called Bullshit Inc. And it researches new ideas and excuses and justifications and reasons that even though my life's been burned to the ground, this time when I do it, somehow, some way, I'm going to be able to control and enjoy it. And when I'm in sobriety, the liar comes out of remission, says, hey, we need a solution. And the problem is that the liar would always win the argument. And I would relapse. I would pick up and go back out. Another problem I see in the rooms is some people, they don't relapse. They go insane. And the suicide rates in 12-step rooms is 80 times higher than normal society. That's in the Oxford Handbook to Psychiatry. An untreated addict is 80 times more likely to take their own life in the first 5 years of untreated addiction or alcoholism. It's a real problem. I've seen it happen. I've buried 41 people in 18 years of working with others. And out of the 41 that I buried, 9 took their own lives in sobriety. They hung themselves. They could not, would not see our way of life. And this is the horror behind step one. It's the realization, I can't stop. Somehow, some way, I will, like the dog returning to its vomit, pick up and use again. That's what makes me an addict. And it's horrifying because I'm pursuing my love of drugs and alcohol to the gates of insanity or death. Raise your hand if you know someone who's died from addiction. Like, if you got it, it's a death sentence. And it's horrifying. Nothing secular, nothing human will stop me. Yet we come into the rooms and we meet people just like ourselves who have gone down that rabbit hole even further than I've gone. They're just like me, but they don't do it anymore. And that's a very compelling picture to someone who wants to stop but can't stop. And I met a man in the rooms. He approached me after 8 months of watching me go insane. And he says, Cameron, I'm watching you die. Let me show you how to work a program. And because of his generosity of spirit, he was armed with the facts about himself, and he had a solution, which was the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. He showed me a way out of that hole. And today, 18 years, I drank and used morning, noon, and night from the age of 20 to 46, to from the age of 46, I'm 64 now, where I've had no desire to drink or use, or easily able to control that desire to drink or use. Right? I'm an alcoholic addict who doesn't drink or use. That's a paradoxical thing for me to say, for any one of us to say, because everything my experience tells me I will, and yet I don't. And that's the miracle of our program. That's the miracle of the 12 Steps to Cocaine Anonymous. And as a result of the program, I was able to rebuild a destroyed marriage, the love and trust of my children. My liver went back to normal. I went back to university, graduated medical anthropology and religions, And, oh, here are three good predictors of recovery. One, we work with others. Two, we go back to school and improve ourselves. And three, you know what the third thing is? We fix our teeth. I don't know what it is about teeth, but when the addict starts fixing their teeth, you know, they got a good program going on. And it's been a stellar life being a member of Cocaine Anonymous. This is what it means to me to be a member of Cocaine Anonymous. I'm an alcoholic addict who doesn't drink or use. If you're drinking and using, you're not really a member. You're just an alcoholic addict. But membership means I'm an alcoholic addict, doesn't drink or use. And that's kind of the hair that I split. Relapse is what makes us addicts. If we didn't relapse, we wouldn't need to be here. If any one of you had a defense against relapsing, would you be sitting here on the channel listening to this dickweed talk for the next 30 minutes? I don't think so, right? So, I sometimes hear people say relapse is part of recovery. Relapse is not part of recovery. Relapse is part of the problem. And it's a death sentence if we'd be those, you know, those real addicts of the hopeless, seemingly hopeless variety. The other thing I find bewildering is when sponsors fire their prospects for relapsing. Hell, if I could come into the rooms and not relapse, what the fuck do I need you for? Right? And I hear about sponsors firing people for relapse. I just find it mind-boggling. Now, some of you know that I teach a workshop at the end of every month called 12 Steps in 4 Hours. And one of the mottos we have in our program of that group is that it only takes a few hours or a day or so to learn how to work a 12-step program and the rest of your life to work it. It only takes a few hours to learn it. It's not rocket science. It's a pretty simple program. So if it only takes a day or so to learn it and the rest of your life to work it, why is it that we see so much relapse in the rooms? Now, part of the situation is half measures avail us nothing, and faith without works is dead. And I've always thought they'd make great slogans. I see over here we have slogans posted in the rooms. I don't know whether you guys do the same over there in the UK, but over here we got slogans up on the walls. And, you know, like, remember when, think, you know, play the tape all the way through, first things first, all that kind of stuff. But I think faith without works is dead and half measures avail us nothing are two really poignant slogans. They're good messages. So over the years, I've worked with well over 5,000 people in the rooms. I've carried the message over 5,000 through the 12 steps in 4 hours. I'm not saying this to brag. I just say I got a lot of experience working with newcomers and people wanting to find a way out of that inescapable hole. I've personally worked with people. When I take people through the steps, I usually do it in about a week. I've worked with some close to 400 people in that approach. And so I have a lot of experience working with people, and relapse is certainly part and parcel to that. So if it only takes a few hours to learn how to work it and the rest of our lives, you know, to make it happen, why is it we see relapse? And having worked with a lot of these people, it comes down to basically this. And this is why I like those two phrases, half measures avail us nothing and faith without works is dead. So inevitably what happens is someone who learns the program, somewhere in the program, they're not doing it. There's some half measure or something that's out of whack. And ultimately I find for those that relapse is they just stop working their program. So this share is kind of a synopsis of all those stories I've heard. And then I'm going to give you an approach to help someone diagnose whether or not they suffer from that spiritual malady, which activates the liar. And as we all know, the liar always wins the argument. And then how can we probe the person's program to find out where they're falling short, where the half measure is, where there is no faith, or where there's faith but no work. And if you like this approach, I'll post the link in the chat after the share. And you can, for those of you that are sponsoring others, you can add it to your sponsorship toolkit. And those of you that are struggling, you can use it to help, you know, illuminate where in your program you might be coming up short. So this is This is a synopsis of all these stories. So I got sober by working the 12 steps of Cocaine Anonymous. And of course, that was a miracle in my life because for years, the only thing on my mind, morning, noon, and night, was how do I get high, you know, stay high or get higher. And the desire to drink or use drugs was gone. That's the miracle. I got no desire to drink or use. Oh my God. Life was great. Family relationships improved. I started working again. I was able to save a little money. And then I went on cruise control. And I got cocky. And I got complacent. And my program began to waver. The first principle I let go of was unselfish work with other addicts. This is my 12th step. Intensive work with other addicts was too strenuous. I was too busy to carry the message to other suffering addicts. So I stopped working with newcomers and having fellowship with other recovered addicts. Next to go was my step 11. I stopped listening to God through meditation. Eventually, I also stopped talking to God through prayer, and my conscious contact with God was diminished. And what used to be an intuitive direction now became muddled confusion. Next, step 10 ceased to be part of my daily routine. I got bogged down with the minutiae of life. I stopped watching for selfishness and dishonesty and resentment and fear. I stopped asking God for guidance. I stopped discussing my shortcomings with others. I didn't bother to clean up my mistakes or make amends for my wrongdoings, nor did I turn my thoughts to someone I could help. And when I quit working my daily program of action, my spiritual fitness began to really wane. I no longer wanted to clean up my past and set matters right. I discarded my step 8 list of people I'd harmed and ceased to make any further direct amends as suggested in step 9. Guilt, shame, remorse over the things I'd done began to creep back into my life, and that disturbed my peace and serenity. Next, step 7 ceased being part of my evening prayer and meditation. I no longer asked God to remove my character defects, nor did I ask God to give me the strength to be honest, pure, unselfish, and loving. And with that, I ceased doing step 6. I failed to see the futility, the fatality of my character defects and their terrible destructiveness. My shortcomings were no longer objectionable, and I became unwilling to let them go. Next to go was step 4 and 5. I no longer confessed my shortcomings with others because I stopped taking a fearless and moral inventory of myself. Resentments, fears, harms to others began to pile up, and once again I became blocked from the sunlight of the Spirit. Now I no longer wanted to turn my life and my will over to God as suggested in step 3. I had better ideas. 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, and self-pity drove me to selfish and self-centered behaviors. And I gave up searching for the great reality deep down within me, and I became unwilling to believe in a power greater than myself. I lost faith in my step 2, and once again, lack of power became my dilemma. Having no power, I had no defense against my addiction, that my sound reasoning failed to hold me in check. The insane idea won out. All had gone well for a time and relapse was unthinkable, but I failed to enlarge my spiritual life, and to my consternation, I found myself drunk and high in a very short period of time. Once again, I was at step 1. I was powerless over cocaine and all other mind-altering substances, and my life had become unmanageable. Now, I've heard this story many times over the years of working with others. Question is what can the relapser do about it? Well, I've got good news and bad news. First, the bad news. Unless we can experience an entire psychic change, that means no half measures, there's very little hope of recovery. The good news is there is a solution. Now, the Big Book promises, it states on page 64, when the spiritual malady is overcome, our mind and body straightens out. So I want you to imagine 3 layers. The first layer is our bodily reaction to alcohol and drugs when we ingest them. That's that physical craving. That feeling comes over us. Our body reacts. It's like, wow, yeah, this is the way I want to feel. Under that is a second layer, and that's the insanity of the mind, which I call the liar, just before that first drink or drug. That's that mental obsession. And under that is the third layer, the inward condition that triggers the liar, which triggers the picking up of the first drink or the drug. And that third layer is called the spiritual malady. Now, symptoms of this third layer are described in the big book. So I'm going to ask 15 questions. So just do a mental note in your head, yes or no, as I go through them. So we want to see if the person who's relapsing is suffering from this spiritual malady. So number one, having trouble with personal relationships. Two, not being able to control our emotional natures. Three, being prey to or suffering from misery and depression. Four, not being able to make a living or a successful life. Five, having feelings of uselessness. Six, being full of fear. Seven, unhappiness. Eight, inability to be of real help to other people. Nine, being like the actor who wants to run the whole show. 10, being driven by fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, self-pity. 11, self-will run riot. 12, leading a double life. 13, living like a tornado running through the lives of others. 14, exhibiting selfish and inconsiderate habits. And 15, being restless, irritable, and discontented. So ask yourself, am I suffering from this spiritual malady? Particularly if you haven't had a drink or a drug in a while. Currently, what is the condition of your inner life? Are you experiencing any of the symptoms listed previously? Now, when I'm working with a newcomer or when I'm working with a relapser, they're usually getting 13, 14, 15 out of 15 yeses to these symptoms. Now, occasionally these symptoms will come up for me, but because I use my program daily, I'm able to easily work through them and come out on top. But to someone who's not working a program or doesn't know how to work a program, there's not much hope that they're going to be able to do that. So the question is, if you are suffering from those symptoms, what can you do about it? Because it's the symptoms that activate the liar. And the liar says, hey, we need a solution. And the liar goes to work. And because we have no defense, inevitably we do pick up or drink, or worse yet, we go insane and take our own lives. So here are the questions I ask to probe in a relapser's life where the problem is. The first question I ask is, when was the last time you took another addict through the steps? Do you know we got people in the program that have done the first 11 steps and have never carried the message to another person, like sat down and show them how to work it? And that's a real problem. When was the last time you took someone through the steps? And remember, a kindly act once in a while isn't enough. Two, how long has it been since you've gone through the steps? When was the last time you really thoroughly did all your steps? Now, if you're living rigorously in 10 and 11, you're pretty much working the program. But I do thorough fours and fives on a regular basis. I remember my sponsor saying to me, Cameron, lots of fours and fives, lots of eights and nines. Have you ever taken all of CA's 12 steps? Four, have you done more than one four-step inventory? And if when was the last time you did that? Five, have you completed all of your ninth step amends wherever possible? And if no, what remains to be done? That's another big area I see people that have trouble staying sober, is there's a lot of amends that need to be made that they're not doing. Six, is there something wrong in your life that you will not face and make right? And if so, what is that? You know, it could be a relationship with someone, it could be a wrong career, it could be any number of possibilities. But is there something wrong in your life that you will not face and make right? Seven, is there a bad habit or an indulgence, other than the obvious one, or character defect you will not give up? If yes, what is it? You know, I have a reoccurring character defect of hatred and fear of authority and fear of no control constantly coming up, constantly trying to circumvent and create unrest in my life. And because I work a program, I'm able to deal with that and chisel away through inventory to scrape that like a barnacle from my hull. But, you know, some people, and we hold on to these bad habits or indulgences. For example, smoking, whether it's vaping or smoking, there's a direct correlation between cigarette smoking and relapse. That's a bad habit that should be looked at. Some guys, you know, there's you know, pornography in their life, and it's become problematic. Something that is not conducive to an honest program. I remember working with a guy who was a chronic relapser. I couldn't figure out what was going on. And then I asked him, I said, what kind of work do you do? And he goes, well, I'm doing telemarketing scams. I'm thinking, how the hell do you expect to work an honest program if you're ripping people off in telemarketing scams, right? You know, it was a real problem. Is there a wrong relationship in your life that you will not give up? And if yes, what is it? Now, it could be a relationship with a person. Could be a relationship with a process like sex or gambling or hoarding or codependence or what have you. It could be a wrong relationship with a thing, you know. Alcohol and drugs is the obvious one. But, you know, there's lots of things we can have wrong relationships with. If so, what is that? Is there a restitution you will not make? The 11th question that I ask, is there something God has told you to do that you will not obey? And if yes, what is it? Early on when I started delivering my message, I was very crass and very vulgar. And people would often give me feedback about that. And some people were really distraught by some of the languaging and, you know, vulgar metaphors that I'd use when presenting. And I refused to look at it for a long time, mostly out of fear that I couldn't be a good speaker unless I was constantly aggravating my audience. And it was through inventory that I began, because it kept coming up, it was like God saying, look at it, look at it, look at it. And then eventually I started doing inventories and I started looking at the self-seeking motives behind my vulgar language, which was validation, center of attention, recognition, and I had to employ the principles of faith and courage, that faith, God needs me to do this, and the courage to be a man that can deliver a presentation without all the vulgarities and still deliver a strong message. And, you know, when I started doing more of my shares without the vulgarity, I found them more inclusive, and they were more powerful than ever, you know. So is there something God is telling you to do that you simply will not obey? And if so, what's that? And the 12th thing that I ask, 12th question, is, are you working with the disciplines and the practices of steps 10 and 11, self-examination, meditation, and prayer consistently every day? Now, if you use those 15 questions with your prospect or your relapser and have a good, honest conversation and probe, I guarantee you're going to get some really good value from that, and you're going to help them kind of zero in on where the problem or problems may lie. So in conclusion, it's easy to let up on the spiritual program of action and rest on our laurels. And we're headed for trouble if we do, because alcohol or drugs is a subtle foe. Remember, the liar's out to kill us, right? We're not cured of our addiction. What we do is, through our program, we put the liar into remission. What we have is a daily reprieve contingent on the maintenance of our spiritual condition. Every day is the day we must carry the vision of God's will into all our activities. How can I best serve thee? Thy will, not mine, be done. These are thoughts, these spiritual principles that we learn go with us constantly. We can exercise our willpower along this line all we wish. Remember, we never give up our willpower. We use our willpower to do God's will. That's the proper use of the will. God's will, not self-will. The spiritual life is not a theory. We have to live it. A new life has been given us, or if you prefer, a design for living that really works. And it really does work. It's worked very well in my life for 18 years. This is not an overnight matter. Remember, it's a process, not an event. It should continue for our lifetime. Remember, recovery is not a sprint. It's a marathon for life. And I'm for that. How about you? I'll post the link in the chat. Thank you so much, everyone.